As though he could read my mind, Stevie turned and smiled at me. All in good times, Mags. All in good time. Well, hey folks, welcome to the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Keith Tyler saying thank you so much for tuning in. Let's jump right in. The Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine and author Gabriella Stittler bring us our first story, and it's called A Hard Night's Sleep. It was 3:30 in the morning when Linda called. Next to me, well, the bed was empty. I knew that was wrong before she spoke. "It's Stevie," she said by way of greeting, sounding tired and a little tight at the edges. "I've got him on the corner of Torrey and Ocean Avenue." "Okay, I'm coming," I said. "Something's bad gonna happen if he keeps this up," Linda went on. "You want him to end up dead?" Linda was the sort of neighbor that was always on the periphery of my business. She was a retired kindergarten teacher and had some motion sensor lights on her garage and a small security sign in her window. She played pickleball in the summer, went to Florida during the month of January, and drank white wine spritzers on her patio regardless of season. It wasn't the first time Linda had made a late-night call. Before Angie left for college, when she and her boyfriend would park at the end of the block with the windows fogged, Linda, who was unable to help herself, would report. "She's gonna get knocked up," she'd say. "Is that what you want for her?" "Of course not," I'd say. "Thanks for your concern." I didn't tell her I wasn't worried about Angie. She'd always worked hard, got straight A's, was beloved by her classmates and teachers, and never once gave me a hard night's sleep. Angie, I was certain, would be fine. When she left for college, Linda turned her attention to my younger daughter, JoJo. "You know she's drinking those mini bottles of Fireball and leaving them out in the woods," she said. "You want her to be a drunk?" "Of course not," I'd say. "Thanks for your concern." But JoJo I did worry about. She was a smart kid and angry the way some smart people could be. Things being the way they were, I didn't blame her. If I had time, I'd be angry myself. "Well," Linda prompted with an irritated clip. "Thanks," I said. I was doing the best that I could considering the cards I'd been dealt. I slept between Stevie and the way out, and I'd bought one of those door harps just in case. But then I had always slept hard, and Stevie had always been light on his feet, thoughtful about not waking me up. "Yeah, I'll be right there." I don't know who hung up first. I slid on JoJo's Crocs, my bathrobe, and the headlamp I kept in the mudroom and slipped into the night. It was crisp, the way Novembers in Maine were, and my breath came out in little puffs. It was quiet, other than my feet shuffling through the fallen leaves and Linda's voice echoing down the end of our dead-end street. Everyone, well, except me and Stevie and Linda, was tucked away in bed, sleeping. Stevie and Linda's shadows stretched out beneath the streetlight, him rocking on his heels like he did when he was nervous, her patting his hand and murmuring about nothing, nothing, nothing of importance. She had pulled on one of those puffy down jackets that made Maine winters bearable and was wearing her running shoes with no socks. She didn't look happy, and I didn't blame her. Stevie was wearing slippers and no coat, and he was peering down at her, his brow furrowed. In the harsh light, he looked old. But when he saw me approach, he broke into one of those crooked grins that reminded me of the hundreds of little ways he'd charmed me when we'd first fallen in love. "Hiya, Stevie," I said.
"He wants to get donuts," Linda said, not letting go of his hand, as though she were holding a dog's leash, as though he might bolt.
"Sure," I said, reaching out to him. "We love donuts." He twined his fingers with mine, and some part of him still recognizing the threads that bound our lives together. I tightened my grip. He smiled.
"But it's too early, isn't it?" Linda asked,
for Stevie's benefit. I nodded.
"Yeah, Tony doesn't open till 7.
Stevie, studying me, also nodded. "And you remember that Angie is coming? With Corey?" I said, and the three of us began the slow walk back to the house. "Angie," Stevie said, like he was tasting the name. Angie, who he'd taught to ride a bike and throw a ball, who he'd carried on his shoulders in the woods behind our house, who he'd made blueberry pancakes for on Sundays when the season was right. Hey, I like that name. I would have liked to think it got easier, but every time it stung. Linda turned her attention from Stevie to me, and I shifted on my feet. "For the first time in a year, we'll have both our girls home," I went on in that careful, neutral tone I'd honed in the last 3 years. He nodded along, like he knew. Stevie sometimes wandered, but even with his condition, he was generally agreeable, as he always had been. Angie had inherited his gentle and forgiving temperament, and JoJo had been stuck with mine. We approached our house, the one Stevie and I bought 22 years ago when we were still kids ourselves, with the cedar shingles he'd replaced and the mudroom he'd built 12 years earlier, where the girls had left their snow pants in a wet pile and the towels and buckets of shells from the long summer days we'd spent on Old Orchard Beach, on the boardwalk, or at the arcade. Our house with the shed that needed to be replaced, and the leaky dining room windows and the loose screen door. All of the many projects we had planned to get to. As though he could read my mind, Stevie turned and smiled at me. "All in good time, Megs. All in good time." And then he shuffled up the stairs and disappeared inside. Those moments of lucidity, they stung too. The kitchen light was on, which meant JoJo was up. She had always been close to Stevie, and sometimes I wondered if a piece of her subconscious was tied to him. Linda and I stood under the streetlight, me staring at the shadows in the kitchen, her staring at me. "Thanks again." It sounded hollow, but what else was there to say? "He's getting worse," she said, in a blunt way that a certain class of old-school New Englanders could be when communicating. 3 times in 2 weeks, Maggie. He could walk into traffic. If the weather was a little colder, he could fall into the cove and freeze. It's not safe." She was right, of course. She was. JoJo pulled up the blind, nodded at me, and dropped it. Linda took in the interaction, then her eyes fixed on me. And maybe they softened.
"And you can't keep this up. If he doesn't hurt himself, he'll hurt somebody else. He's not getting better."
"Sure," I said.
"Right, I know."
He wasn't. It would only get worse. But the alternative was a small gray room at Canco Assisted Living Facility with linoleum floors and narrow windows. I'd toured the place 3 times. It was sterile and orderly and all the things that would drive Stevie crazy. Sending him there, that would be a death sentence.
"Do something now," Linda said, "before something bad happens." And she took my hand and squeezed it once before walking away.
I went inside. The kitchen smelled like coffee, and the sound of the television in the living room played in the background. JoJo was sitting at the table, a bowl of Lucky Charms in front of her. JoJo, who was 16, going on 40.
Morning, I said and forced a smile. She wouldn't catch my eye. I'm looking forward to seeing Angie today, I went on carefully, and I'm hoping it's a good visit for everyone. It was my gentle way of saying, for goodness sake, Jojo, don't piss on your sister's boyfriend the minute he walks in. Angie's boyfriend, Corey, was older and a little too shiny to be trusted. I knew it. Jojo knew it. Even Stevie knew it. But Angie hadn't figured it out yet, and she wouldn't if Corey became one of those forbidden fruits. Angie was the loyal sort to go down with the ship. Jojo scowled. She was the sort to set the ship on fire. Ah, this is going to be a disaster, she said. Maybe she was right. The last time Angie brought Corey, things had not gone well. But I didn't know how many holidays we had left as a family of four. And I said as much. If not for me, keep it together for him. Just try, okay? We both knew I meant Stevie, the point around which we all pivoted. Sure, Mom, she said in a flat voice that wasn't at all reassuring. She stood up and took her bowl to the sink. She had filled out in the last year, all the gauntness from early adolescence having given way to a woman's body, which sometimes kept me up at night. She was still my baby, a kid, but I saw the way men looked at her. When Angie hit this stage, she had attached herself to a boyfriend, and he buffered her from the worst of it. Jojo, however, did not want to be buffered, and I was not equipped to parent the sort of chaos swirling around her. She left the kitchen. I took a cup of coffee to Stevie, who was sleeping on the couch. Jojo sat next to him, staring at the news on the muted television, her legs curled up under her and a blanket on her lap. I put the turkey in the oven, poured myself another cup of coffee, and tried not to think about much of anything. 3 years ago, after a particularly bad appointment with a particularly brutal specialist in Boston, Stevie and I went to dinner in one of those places he liked on the water in Portland. It was mid-August, and the place was swarming. The girls were at camp, and the reality of our situation hung in the air, in all the things we hadn't yet said. We'd already been through the denial and the worst of the anger, and had moved through to some of the sadness. Stevie, being Stevie, ordered a beer and smiled across the table at me, the sunset reflecting off the water in so many shades of pink and orange and yellow, it was like looking through a kaleidoscope. All the pieces of something familiar fractured and scattered. I reached to my bag, to my notebook, the one with every detail and plan and question we needed to sort through before it was too late. He smiled, like he knew the workings of my mind, and reached across the table and took my hand. All in good time, he said, a gentle prod for me to slow down, to worry less. A well-worn refrain in our marriage. I wanted to say, we don't have time. I can't afford to slow down. If I don't worry, who will? Somebody has to keep the train on the tracks. But he spoke first. Happy anniversary, he said. And for all my scribbling and planning, that particular detail had slipped my mind. In his own way, even in that moment, he was taking care of me. Angie and Corey arrived a few minutes earlier than expected, bearing pies. She didn't look like a college kid. College kids were supposed to be bleary-eyed and in sweats. But then she'd always acted a little older and wiser. Mom, she said. Her smile was a touch too bright, and when I wrapped my arms around her, she pulled back. You look good, I said, but wasn't sure if I meant it. She was wearing a soft pink sweater, but under the bulk of that mohair I could tell she'd lost weight. Maybe too much? Not that I was doing better. I couldn't remember the last time I'd made it to a hair appointment or eaten a meal I'd enjoyed. Between the two of us, Stevie had been the cook. Early on, we'd settled into a routine. He'd pour me a glass of wine and prepare dinner. I'd watch. Sometimes we'd put on music, sometimes the news, but mostly we'd have the small, intimate sorts of conversations couples have. Conversations I missed with a dull ache somewhere deep in my chest. "Well, you both look like crap," JoJo said, peering down over the banister. Angie stepped away. "Well, nice to see you too." JoJo turned her attention to Corey, who was leaning against the wall, taking everything in with a look of mild irritation, as was his habit. Her eyes narrowed, and I braced myself. JoJo had never been good at hiding her feelings. "We are so glad you made it," I rushed to say, throwing her a warning look. "Aren't we?" JoJo's mouth tightened. "Sure. Thrilled," she said. Stevie looked up from the puzzle he'd been piecing together on the coffee table. A flicker of something almost like recognition passed when he saw Angie. She smiled big and bright and hopeful. "Hi, Stevie," she said. We had learned it was easier for the girls to say Stevie. Dad caused confusion and guilt and a deep sadness. But hearing her say it was another blow. Stevie smiled. Hi, he said. And then he noticed Corey. His expression closed off. The girls, on some level, he understood to be his. Corey, he knew instinctively, was not. The room felt too small for all of us. An awkward silence stretched. Corey took out his phone. Stevie went back to staring at his puzzle. JoJo darted back upstairs. Let me put the pies away, I said to Angie, and made for the kitchen. She followed me, put the pies on the counter, and said in a low voice, "He's getting worse, isn't he?" I shrugged. "Later. We can talk about that later. I want to hear about you, about college, about anything other than Stevie and the inevitable descent." JoJo joined us, dressed from head to toe in black. "Oh, geez," Angie said. "Who died?" "What Easter bunny did you murder for your sweater?" JoJo hit back. Angie smiled. JoJo smiled. And some of the tension between my shoulders eased. "Tell us about college," I said again, but was met with silence. I looked up and cleared my throat. Angie shrugged, but was not catching eye contact. JoJo's eyes darted between the two of us, and her lips pulled down. Something was wrong. My maternal instinct was kicking up all sorts of dust, and JoJo had picked up on it too. But before I could press, there was a crash in the living room. Stevie had knocked over the card table and the puzzle, and Corey looked pissed. As I cleaned up the mess, all I could think about was the way Angie flinched at that noise, the way at certain angles and in certain lighting, it looked like she had a bruise on her right cheek, the way JoJo had been staring at her, taking it all in. When the girls were little, I would go around the table listing the ways in which we were grateful. A litany of appreciation, friends, family, the dog Jack who had died earlier this year. A roof over our head, each other, food, books and music and gas in the car and a paycheck and bacon and hot tea and shoes that fit well and nature and those golden finches with their bright bellies and all the little things that the girls think of. Socks and stickers and stuffies. Then Stevie would tell the same story of Thanksgiving at his grandmother's house and describe in detail his 7 cousins. The older the girls got, the more vibrant his cousins became. As was often the case with Stevie and his stories, I wondered how much truth was buried underneath. It had been 3 years since the litany of gratitude, since the stories of the cousins. 3 years of my dry turkey and soupy mashed potatoes. We 4 sat in silence, none of us eating. The memories spread between us, a veritable feast. And Corey was talking about his job. Again. Jojo pushed the mashed potatoes on her plate, and Stevie was staring at Angie. Corey cracked another beer. You look a little like me, Stevie said, and reached across the table, taking Angie's hand. Corey caught the movement and frowned. Jojo's chin inched up, and I braced myself. How is school? She asked, repeating my question from earlier. Angie looked down at her plate. Stevie frowned. You didn't tell them yet, Corey asked, his voice cold and disappointed. Stevie turned his attention to Corey, his hand closing into a tight fist. Does anyone want more turkey? I asked, standing up. She's moving in with me, Corey went on, reaching his arm out around the back of the chair. You're dropping out? Jojo asked, staring at her sister. Corey started to say something. Jojo cut him off. You forgot how to speak for yourself?
Just a break, just for now, Angie said. Until all this is easier to manage,
she gestured at the table. At me? At Stevie. But the way she said it, I knew it was BS. Angie, my baby, who earned straight A's, who studied for every test, who had worked hard as hell for that full ride to USM, who had wanted to be a pediatrician and had mapped out her life accordingly. My baby, who was soft and loyal and stubborn.
You okay with this? Jojo said, turning that hard expression on me.
I didn't say anything. What was there to say? I knew what I saw. Anything I said would be oil on fire, and I wasn't trying to do more damage. Things were bad enough as they were. Jojo's eyes widened, and she let out a hard laugh. This is baloney, she said, and left the table.
Little like me, Stevie repeated, staring after her.
Nobody ate the pie. I'd stacked the dishes next to the sink and was loading the dishwasher when Angie came into the kitchen.
I'm sorry, I didn't tell you, she said, and she sounded tired.
It would have been better to say nothing, I knew it, but I was tired too, and I didn't have it in me to tiptoe around all the things stretching between us.
You've always wanted. I'm allowed to change, she said, like she knew where I was going.
The anger in the pit of my stomach unfurled, that she'd already thought through all the reasons this was the wrong choice. She was going to ignore them.
For him? You really think he's the one? We're throwing away everything?
From the way she went rigid, I knew I'd said the wrong thing. But even then, I couldn't stop the frustration that had been slowly boiling.
I know you got a lot to manage, Mom, really, but it's my life, my choices, your mistakes, I said, and jeez, did I sound bitter.
In the next room, Stevie was stuck on a loop. He was repeating something over and over and over, and laughing as if it were some clever joke that only he understood. Corey turned up the volume on the television.
You know better, I said to Angie.
She let out a breath. We talked. First thing tomorrow, we're heading back, okay? It's just, this is all too much. It's not good for Dad. It's not good for you. And it's not good for me.
A little piece of my heart cracked.
I'm fine, I said. Everything is going to be fine. She stared at me for a minute, and I went back to putting the dishes in the dishwasher. When I looked at where she'd been, she was gone. Later that night, Jojo wasn't talking to me. Angie and Corey had shut the door to their room, and Stevie found me sitting on our bed, staring at the wall.
You're not okay, he said, slipping his hand into mine, despite everything he knew my moods.
No, I'm fine, I said, the familiar lie tasting like sand. There was a minute of silence.
You are a terrible liar, he said, and that was true.
It was a conversation we'd had so many times it might have been scripted.
It wasn't supposed to be like this, I said.
Something familiar sparked in his eyes, like he recognized the pathway to that particular conversation.
What fun would it be if we planned for everything?
I thought about all the carefully laid plans, all the sacrifices made over 25 years of marriage, of all the small fights, the big ones, all in service of what?
I don't know what to do, I said, and very badly wanted to cry.
He draped his arm over my shoulder and promised that everything would be okay. I helped him through his evening routine, washing his face, brushing his teeth, changing into his pajamas, pulling back the covers, just like we'd done for our girls.
He has a mean smile, Stevie was saying as he lay in our bed, staring at his hands, like they didn't belong to him.
They're leaving tomorrow, I said.
He won't come back, he said, and it sounded like a promise.
I know, I said, that weight on my chest getting good and comfortable. I couldn't bring myself to tell him that Angie wouldn't come back either.
Stevie didn't say anything, and I went into the shower and stripped off my clothes and waited until the water was bearing down on me before I started to cry.
A few months into our relationship, when Stevie and I were kids living in separate apartments on Munjoy Hill, back when the neighborhood was dicey and the state theater played pornographic films, Stevie showed up at my doorstep with a beach bag and a bouquet of blossoms from a blue hydrangea.
They reminded me of your eyes, he said.
We'd gone to Peaks Island and eaten cherries and drunk the warm beer he'd packed and almost missed the last ferry back. We talked about everything and nothing, the way kids in love do. I had confessed that I'd grown up fast, leaving out my mother's addiction, and that I was good at managing details. Stevie had been watching me so carefully, studying me like I held some great secret. If he'd stared long enough,
you ever let anybody take care of you?
I had assured him that I could take care of myself, that I'd been doing it my entire life, and then I changed the subject.
Today was a fun day, I said cautiously as we walked up the hill to my tiny studio apartment.
It was still early in our relationship, and everything felt tentative and soft, and even then some part of me worried that my hard edges would sink us.
Mags, he had said with that crooked charm he was good at throwing off,
you and me would do a good job taking care of each other.
That night, as I lay in my bed with the windows open, listening to boat horns and the train whistle, I knew he meant it.
It was around 4 a.m. when I woke up to the sound of somebody screaming. Next to me, the bed was empty. Jojo and Angie were standing at the top of the basement steps. At the bottom lay Corey's body. His head had cracked like a shell of a robin's egg against the concrete floor. Angie was screaming and sobbing, and Jojo was gripping her arm, tethering her in place.
Oh my gosh, I said, oh my gosh.
Jojo was staring past me, a fierce, protective look on her face. I followed her gaze to the living room where Stevie was sitting with his puzzle, the television muted, smiling.
Right, I'm going to switch over to a different Elderly Queen mystery magazine. The story is called Still Dead,
and it's written by Matt Coward.
Do you ever get the giggles?
I tried not to show it, but I always found that question slightly annoying. It really ought to go without saying that being able to resist twitching, coughing, scratching, snoring, and, above all, giggling is a pretty basic requirement in my job. No one wants to see a corpse giggling.
No, I said, no more than any other actor.
Amy blushed, as well she might, I trusted. She was blushing at her gaffe toward a fellow cast member, rather than at my use of the word actor. I did go to drama school, a fact I rarely mention because it always gets a laugh. No, they didn't have a module on being a dead body, but they did have a remarkably blunt tutor who told me during my graduation interview,
"Kid, you're going to need a specialty."
She poured me a large glass of sweet white wine.
"You're not noticeable enough to be a lead or a character. You're not tall enough, handsome enough, talented enough. You're never going to be a heartthrob."
She looked me up and down.
"Or any kind of throb. Only way you'll make a living in this business is by finding something you can do that others can't or don't want to do and sticking to it."
She drained her wine to signal that that was the end of the conversation.
"Either that or become a drama teacher."
In retrospect, I'm sure she only added that so as to allow me the dignity of the last word. "I'd rather die," I said. When I got home, I asked my parents what, not whether, but which, special talent they had proudly spotted in me over the years. Without taking their eyes off the television, Mum said, "Lying around all day," and Dad said, "Doing naught." Some have graveness thrust upon them. Usually I prefer working in theater. Whatever happens, it's all over in a couple of hours. Whereas in any recorded medium, you are always at the mercy of the redo. I once portrayed a careless commuter in a safety training film for railway staff. My sole scene, an actor playing an elderly passenger, appears at the top of a flight of stairs, sees my lifeless body at the bottom, screams, "Cut, that's me done, home time." It took 4 days. The director kept saying he wasn't feeling it. Lucky him. But there's theater and theater. This wasn't a long run at a storied West End house of dreams a few doors down from a late-night Italian restaurant. This was one night of open-air theater in a disused and partly derelict factory on a fading industrial estate on the outskirts of Dudley. Audience, please bring own chairs or perch on rubble. Tonight was my first sight of the venue. They used a dummy during rehearsals. I wasn't required. A bit of a sore point. I'm an actor and a member of the cast. I should be at rehearsals. The stage was what used to be and what was left of the reception area. "What did they make here when it was still going?" I asked the blushing actress, and in doing so inadvertently blushed her up again.
"Medical items," she said, and I was trying to think of something to ask her which would cause further embarrassment. She was to play my daughter in tonight's entertainment, after all, and I didn't want to get off on the wrong foot when I heard a voice which made me long to kill someone. I mean, someone specific. I'm not a psycho.
"Hey, corpse boy," cried Barnaby.
The someone I longed to kill, throwing a sweaty arm around my shoulder.
"As soon as I saw the script, I knew they'd be calling my old friend Nye to give us his fabled dead Irishman. Can you do the accent? Oh, no, wait a minute. You don't need to, do you?"
I shouldn't let it bother me, but I long ago decided that I would.
By any professional or craft-based measurement, I'm a successful actor. How many actors do you know who are never out of work, never between engagements? Or if you prefer a reputational metric, I can honestly say that I am known throughout the business as a reliable, punctual, sober, and all in all the first name on the list when a casting director is looking for someone to play dead. Barnaby, I replied, and that was all he was getting from me. I'd worked with him twice before and would happily never have done so once again. I considered him bumptious, sly, selfish, and inefficient. Forgivable flaws, perhaps, if he hadn't been so happy to make it clear at every opportunity that he found my profession, my trade, my craft, shall we call it my niche, hilariously absurd. "Tell you what, old Nye," he said over his shoulder as he sauntered off, "if you behave yourself, I'll buy you a drink after the show. Yours is the pint of embalming fluid, if I remember all right." We watched him walk away, chuckling to himself. "I gather you already know our event manager," said Amy. Yeah, we've met," I admitted. "Not sure I've ever seen him in such a buoyant mood, though. Except that time the leading lady forgot her lines and burst into tears on stage." Amy's blush, which I was beginning to realize was ever present, deepened. "He's got a new girlfriend." "Extraordinary," I shuddered. "And she's much younger than him, and she's got a lovely flat in Edgbaston, and Barnaby's moved in with her." "People are inexplicable," I said. I felt the need for a nice lie-down. Good thing the play was about to start. I didn't have any lines in this one, which pleased me. As often as not, I do, but there's little satisfaction in delivering variations on, "What's that in your hand? No, don't shoot! Arg!" My part, even so, was a big one. I was the only character on stage throughout, on stage when the lights went up, and still on stage when they went down. The entire piece, I may say, without vanity, revolved around me. Giggling, to which I am not prone, let it be known, would be particularly inappropriate in this play, an Irish two-act job about patriarchy, filial duty, and death set in the rural 1950s. I portrayed the patriarch, who had died shortly before kickoff. He lay on the kitchen table as his sons and daughter came to speak their last words to him. Very few laughs, none of them intentional. I was lying with my feet toward the audience at an angle which I was confident prevented them from seeing my eyes. That was good, because it meant I could watch. I like watching audiences, bored or gripped, exciting to be there or dragged by the insistent spouses. They all provide me with gentle entertainment. I take sentimental pleasure from the loving couples staring at each other rather than at the stage. I like watching the tipsy fall asleep. I love it when they are startled awake by their own snores, happy to regain consciousness during a silent pause on the stage, and are frozen by the fear that it might be due to the same noise that woke them up. My view was restricted, not least by my own boots, but I could see all of the left side of the front row and a little way beyond. Occasionally I was alone on stage for brief periods, presumably to allow everyone to ponder on the mysteries of mortality, during which moments everything was dead quiet, and I could hear whispered conversations. "Mom, is that man really dead?" is one I often eavesdrop. It's always gratifying when Mom replies, "No, love, he's an actor," rather than "he's just pretending." In this manner the time passed, and the play drew to its close. No sooner, I thought, than anyone would have wished, At this point, for one of my vocation, there is always the question of the curtain call. Does the corpse get up and join in? And if not, does he just lie there while everyone else takes a bow? Or does he quietly leave the stage unnoticed and unthanked? In the case of this production, I was modestly gratified to note the centrality of my role was fully acknowledged at the climax. Each actor in turn took up a position front and center and made their final address before exiting to applause, with any luck. Each actor, except me, obviously, or not obviously, perhaps the author missed a trick here. Eventually, only the fallen paterfamilias was left. Alone on stage as he had been at the start, the lights faded, darkness triumphed, and at last the audience could turn its attention to the cramp in its buttocks. At that exact moment there fell upon us a midsummer storm as brief and shocking as the British summer itself, and within minutes the makeshift auditorium emptied of people and of chairs. The stage was sheltered, as anywhere, so I stayed where I was. I have a post-show routine where I am not required for bowing purposes. An athlete might call it warm down, and my procedure does contain an element of all that. As I have learned from hard experience, it is not wise having lain as still as humanly possible for an hour and a half to suddenly jump to one's feet. But more than that, I am concentrating on restoring my mind, my essence, my self, from the intensity of my performance to the plane of the everyday. I knew that Barnaby, as event manager, was contractually obliged to be the last creature standing on the site, so I took as long as I could without risking missing that last order at the bar. By the time I reopened my eyes, we were indeed alone. The spectators had dispersed, and the company were either at or on their way to the pub. I was slightly surprised, perhaps even disappointed, that Barnaby wasn't hassling me to move on so that he could join them. I sat up and looked around for him. "Looks like someone's after your job, Nye," he said, nodding his head toward the last chair left in the whole place. It was a motorized wheelchair on what would have been the extreme left of the front row. Its occupant appeared to be an elderly man, fast asleep, his head lolling. "And he's much better at it than you are, got to say." Barnaby went over to give the guy a not particularly gentle shake. "Wake up, mate, the show's over," he said. And then he screamed. "What is it?" I called. "Oh, my gosh! What? He's not asleep. He's dead." I stayed where I was. Perhaps I should have had some fellow feeling with cadavers, but even as a professional courtesy, I am quite unable to look at the dead, let alone approach them. My head felt light, my legs wobbly, my guts nauseous. I was relieved, though, to know that a man was not, in fact, better than I was pretending to be dead. "What should we do?" Barnaby glanced over at me, clocked my dizzy state, and gave an unpleasant smile. "Not feeling too good, corpse boy? Heh, don't worry. You get over to the pub. Ask one of the girlies to buy you a large brandy for your nerves. I'll deal with this." "Is it a heart attack?" "Yeah, something like that, I guess." He chuckled. "Surely it can't have been the excitement that killed him. Not with this play." Barnaby took out his phone. "I'd better send for an ambulance, I suppose. Seems a waste of a trip, though. They won't need the siren for this one. He's well dead." The most common murderer method in this country, by a huge margin, is stabbing. More than 40% of homicides in England and Wales involve a sharp instrument, and the next biggest category, assault without a weapon, is below 20%. Everything else is in single figures. The corpses I portray are usually shot or bludgeoned. Some years I play more shooting victims than there are actual shooting victims nationwide. All of which goes to prove what I always say. Real life rarely provides a credible reflection of fiction and should therefore not be taken too seriously. It was 8 the next morning when the police, in the person of Detective Sergeant Russell, arrived at my door to tell me that the victim hadn't suffered a heart attack. He'd been suffocated.
"Presumably not in situ," said D.S. Russell. "We don't know for sure yet, but fatal suffocation is harder than people think. It's going to take several minutes, during which the victim will be struggling, groaning, generally making an exhibition of themselves. It's something best done in private."
"You're thinking he was dead before he arrived at the play?"
"Post-mortem will be later today. But meanwhile, the working hypothesis is that he was killed elsewhere, and then the killer used his motorized wheelchair to take him to Yosho and leave him there."
"Who was he?" She shook her head.
"He's been stripped of everything identifying. No phone, wallet, documents, anything like that. Fingerprints aren't in the system. We're waiting for DNA results, but they'll only help if he's already known to us. It's an unusually unhelpful crime scene. The audience took their chairs away with them, so there's no forensics there. The event was free, I understand."
Grant-funded, I confirmed.
"It would have to be." "So," she said, "no booking of tickets. Audience just turned up and then melted away into the night. Which is where you come in, sir."
I put the kettle on. "I suppose I'm a witness of sorts."
"From speaking to your colleagues, I gather that you were on stage throughout, and that your particular role in the production gave you a unique vantage point."
I nodded. "It's true that when the audience can't see my eyes, I do watch them watching us. It's a fascinating study." She raised her eyebrows.
"Really?"
I shrugged. "Or, if not always fascinating, at least time passing."
"There seem to be two possibilities. Either the victim was simply parked there by the killer, who then left the scene. In that case, our only hope lies in identifying the deceased. On the other hand, the murderer may have wanted to stay with the old man, perhaps so that he could appear to interact with him, to prevent anyone suspecting that all was not well."
"And if the killer was there during the play," I said,
"I have seen him."
The doorbell rang.
"That'll be the police sketch artist," said D.S. Russell. "I asked her to join us here."
While the artist was setting up her stuff, I became aware that Russell was scrutinizing my face.
"No," she said at length, "I don't think I've seen you in anything."
"I'm crushed."
"To be fair, I haven't been to the theater since a school trip when I was 15.
"Which you spent snogging, I guessed." She smiled.
"We have no further statement to make concerning that matter at this point in time."
"Right," said the artist.
"Ready for you."
I closed my eyes and took myself back to the previous evening, and in particular to the left side of the front row of last night's audience. If I'd known there was going to be a murder, I would have concentrated my attention less on a very attractive middle-aged woman in a spectacular sari, or at least I might have. I didn't mention that to the police because I didn't know for sure whether fantasizing while feigning death was specifically an offense under law. Next to her, an older woman who spent the whole of her first act fiddling with her smartphone, perhaps in conscious rebellion against the tyranny of generational stereotyping, or perhaps because she was bored to death. To her left was a man in his 60s, jeans, wind cheater, baseball cap. He appeared to be alone, never took his eyes off the stage as far as I saw, never glanced to either side or behind, or stretched his neck muscles, perhaps by looking around. A theater fan, perhaps? Though whether he still would be after 90 minutes of "Da, we'll miss you even so" was moot. Two more to go before the victim himself, a youngish couple or maybe siblings. They were together anyway. I was sure of that, both white with shoulder-length hair, both dressed a little more formally than you would expect for such a venue. Both wore specs, whispered to each other a lot as if commenting on the action. I imagined it would be things like, "Wow, that guy playing the corpse is dynamite, right?" And finally, an old man in a wheelchair who never said or did a thing, didn't even clap at the interval, for which he had a good excuse, as it turned out. It took a couple of hours and several refills of the kettle before we had a set of sketches that the police artist and I both felt happy with. I was thinking, what a fascinating job she had. Very precise, difficult, and vital specialty nestled within a broad art form. Now, who did that remind me of? When it struck me that something was wrong. Wait a minute, I said. Where's the... "The what?" said D.S. Russell, leaning forward. "The guy with the sunglasses," I said, closing my eyes again. They, the youngish couple, or maybe siblings, had made a substitution at halftime, and I'd noticed it because the newcomer was wearing shades, at night, to watch a play, which struck me as pretentious. Otherwise, the man who watched the first act looked similar to the man who replaced him for the second, and they both looked, now I thought about it, and worked on it with the sketch artist, a lot like the woman. I was definitely leaning towards siblings now, rather than a couple or menage a trois as it would have had been. And as his face took shape before me, in my mind and in the sketch, something else came back. The first thing the sunglasses man did when he took over from the other one was take the old man's hand in his. Russell frowned. "Checking he was still dead?" No, clearly not, I said. "So he can only have been checking to make sure he hadn't died, which can only allow one conclusion. Look, D.S. Russell, I would hate to tell you how to do your job." "No, you wouldn't," she sighed. "I'm a copper. Everyone loves to tell me how to do me job." I discovered over the next 20 minutes that it is unsurprisingly and quite properly difficult to persuade police detectives to invest scarce investigational resources into pursuing a half-formed hunches of self-appointed amateur sleuths. "Come on," I wheedled. "I'm hoping to get a series out of this." She wrinkled her nose. "What? The dead man investigates?" "Tell me you haven't watched worse." I paused for the laugh, which didn't come. "Move on. Never let them see your disappointment. Do you agree that if the old man in the wheelchair was alive at any point during the play, then there is only one person who could have killed him?" She rubbed her nose. "I can't see any way around that," she said, and I knew I'd got her. Later that night, D.S. Russell returned to tell me the outcome of the two inquiries I'd asked her to undertake, looking a little fresh than she had 15 hours earlier. She didn't have to tell me anything, of course. I was a mere civilian, but she said she had thought it would be the polite thing to do. Well, entirely incidentally, she had also felt in need of a glass of whiskey while remembering that she had none in stock at her home. Her stereotyping irritated me. Why do people insist on imagining all theater people as dipsomaniacs? I poured her a large one. "The answer to both your questions is yes," she told me and raised her glass in my direction. "You've made an arrest."
Probably tomorrow," said Russell. "Our suspect isn't going anywhere, and meanwhile, we'd like to dig up a few more embarrassing questions before we get to the interview stage."
So the old man was drugged, not dead, when he arrived at the play? Through a swig of scotch, she nodded her head.
"A large but not fatal overdose of pain and anxiety medicines.
He would have been essentially in a very deep sleep for several hours, but he'd have woken up eventually.
And the other matter?
Your friend Barnaby does indeed have two brothers and one sister. He is estranged from all three.
4 nights later, she came round again to inform me that Barnaby had been charged with murder and that he had made a statement against the advice of his solicitor. This time, I had the whiskey poured ready for her to spare her having to hint for it.
Lumbered was the word she used. That was what it came down to.
Two brothers and a sister, all unmarried, were lumbered with a stepfather whom they had loathed all their lives. Their mother had died years ago, while her much older second husband had lived on into a frail and increasingly confused old age. The three siblings had done their duty. They had moved the old man in with them and spent their spare time ministering to him in shifts. But a fourth sibling hadn't. Barnaby had left the family home, left the family, left its problems far behind. He didn't answer their phone messages, their letters, or their emails, let alone their cries for help. Eventually, the dutiful three had enough. By leaving Dad at Barnaby's workplace, they were also leaving a clear message. It's your turn. But Barnaby had too much to lose, I said. A new relationship and a new address, neither of which would have survived being lumbered with a needful relative. So when he recognized the old man left sleeping in the wheelchair in the front row, he suffocated him. Well, I went off to the pub.
And when it was safe to do so, he called an ambulance, we think, said Russell. Though he doesn't admit it, that's when Dad's identity eventually emerged. He planned to blame his siblings for the killing, though it might be that he didn't really stop to plan anything. He just got rid of the immediate problem and hoped for the best.
On her way out, two scotches later, D.S. Russell turned in the doorway to stare at me.
"I definitely don't recognize you from your work," she said. "But then I rarely have time for TV or films."
I didn't ask if she ever watched safety training videos. I'd been below my best in that one. "Seems very unfair," I said. "I contribute to your wages, but you don't return the favor?"
"Don't tell me, bosses, but when I'm working nights, I sometimes keep myself awake with radio plays. Tell me, you ever do any radio?"
Which is the other slightly annoying question I frequently get asked, simply because everyone who says it thinks they're the first. Well, that's it, folks. Join me again next time here on the Mystery Hour, would you please? Thanks. Make sure your I love yous are in order.